listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Kourula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Hollywood, this is your host of the most, Nikki Kourula. We're going to jump right into this episode. Happy New Year, everybody. We have a very talented writer and director joining us today, Mr. Mayank Deogangkar. Did I say your last name right?
Yeah, I mean, it's Deogangkar.
Deogangkar. How does it become a W in there? I see an N.
Yeah, it's the N is kind of like silent. I guess.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Sneaks in. Cool. I don't know.
So it's Deogangkar?
Deogangkar, yeah.
Wow, that's amazing. That's awesome. I love that. So first, where's your family from? I know you're an Indian, like me, but what part of India is your family from?
Yeah, we're originally from Maharashtra, so we're Marathi. Family is mostly based in Nagpur, India. But yeah, I grew up all around, so I don't really consider myself like from one part of India or from one part of the world, you know, like moved around so much that I'm just like I'm here.
Yeah, I saw that you grew up in the UK for a little bit. Like mm-hmm. how old were you when you lived there?
We moved there twice, actually, so we had two stints in the UK, both for like a couple years here and there. So I was quite young, like I don't remember much of it, like probably around 8, 9, 10, 12, like that. So I was quite young. It was, the U.S. is basically where I've grown up from, let's say, 7th grade onwards has been the U.S. So
you're a coconut like me, man.
Yeah, in a way, yes, yes.
Do you speak Hindi or Tamil or any of those languages?
So I speak Hindi. Yeah, I'm like multilingual, like most of us immigrants are. English is kind of my main language, but you know, I speak Hindi. I also speak Marathi a little bit.
Wow.
And yeah, you got to be a polyglot, right? From where we come. So
that's right. You know, my brother and I tease my parents because they only used to speak Hindi to each other or Malayalam, where my family's from, just when they wanted us to not know what they were talking about. So they never actually infiltrated the language into either of our lives in that way. So we always kind of, you know, we tease them about that, but that's awesome. That can't be easy to learn all those languages and then live in so many different cultures. Tell me what that was like for you.
Yeah. I mean, I was born in India. So like learning in the sense like that was my mother tongue, right? So Hindi in our house, even though our family is Maharashtrian, we spoke Hindi mostly. So that's kind of, I grew up on Hindi and then we moved to the UK and then, you know, of course, English, and that is like proper English, if you want to call it. So that was a very different thing. Then I only had that accent as a kid, you know, a British, very, if you [S2] Right. [S1] Can imagine, like a very British accent. And then we moved around again, then to the US, and even in the US, it was like, we lived in Arizona as well. So it's like I had like a weird morph. My accent morphed so much that now it's just this, which it shifts. You know, when I go to India, I have a slightly thicker Indian accent. When I'm here, it just automatically shifts. But yeah, I will say as a kid growing up, it was definitely annoying. You know, we'd move a lot. You know, you'd make friends and you'd be like, oh, okay, now we're moving. But I would say, yeah. And I would say in hindsight, though, like it was very, I don't know how to word it properly, but very much so that it made me more, I feel, inclusive in the sense that I I was around so many different types of folks that it just became like, I never looked at the other as the other. Like, I'm like, oh, this is just a new person I can engage with and interact with.
So, well, that's also intimidating too, as a kid, to go to so many new schools and new countries. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, a lot of people don't realize when you went to the UK, you were probably in boarding school, because that's kind of like what the normal is. Did you go to a boarding school and kind of like there was a little bit of a transition when you did that?
Yeah, it wasn't really a, it wasn't really a boarding school per se, but it was definitely a very different experience. It was what you would, what we would say in the US is a private school, but in the UK, they call it a public school. It's basically like a bit formal, you know, wearing uniforms, like, you know, it was very, very much a strict kind of environment. So that was a very different experience. And then coming to the US, I went to a US public school, which was, which is not the same as a UK public school. US public school is very just, I guess you would compare it to a government school, maybe. I'm not sure what the comparison would be, but it's very much like, you know, people have a dress code, but it's not like there's no uniforms. You wear what you want, and then you, you know, it's a very freeing kind of vibe. And that was the first time I went to an American school. It was a very different kind of like culture shock. I was like, the first day I showed up, I remember I wore like what I was used to wearing, which was like, you know, a formal shirt, pants. And then I showed up and everybody's like in jeans and t-shirts. And I'm like,
what? Why did I dress up for this?
Yeah, why did I dress up for this? So yeah, it's definitely a culture shock for sure.
And what about the actual schooling? Like, I mean, we have recess here. You probably didn't have that in the same way. You probably had like classes that were as like doing, you know, physical activity or like what kind of sports did you kind of do when you were in kid, when you were a kid over in the UK?
Yeah, we did a lot of cricket and a lot of soccer or football. And yeah, that's definitely a thing. Cricket was definitely huge.
You get it? Cricket camps. I still don't understand that game 100%.
Well, I mean, growing up in India, you kind of just, you know, you live cricket for a long time. You know, we would play in the streets and we'd get together. We had this colony. So the colony kids would get together in the local like parking lot and we'd play. And like, so I grew up on cricket. When then I came to the UK, there was a lot of football or soccer. And I remember like, we lived in Newcastle upon Tyne, which at the time, I don't know how much you know about football. It was Newcastle United was one of the bigger teams. And with like, so we actually had like, I went to a camp where Michael Shearer, who was one of the biggest players at the time, came and then he taught us for like a couple of weeks. So
amazing.
I didn't know at the time, again, at the time, like I was like, oh, cool, local hero kind of person. But then in hindsight, I'm like, wow, I got to experience like a legend. So
yeah, it's like one of those things you think it's a casual thing that everybody, you think every neighborhood gets this kind of treatment.
But right.
It's not that way. And also, he was your neighborhood's hero on, as far as like an athlete, but you didn't think he's like a global sensation
because right.
he's your neighborhood team's player. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So absolutely. When did you fall in love with film? Like, did you have family nights where you watch movies? Was it your escape from like school and just like hanging out with friends? Like, tell me when you fell in love with movies.
Yeah. I mean, I was always in love with movies, honestly. But I would say like the defining moment is probably one. So we did have movie nights, that's for sure. Me, my mom and my dad, we'd get together and watch movies. And, you know, my dad and me were more into it. My mom was more, she was like, she was professional, but she was also like the homemaker as well. So she would come in and out, like she would be cooking or something and then come in and watch like 15, 20 minutes, then go back. And then every time she'd come in, she'd be like, okay, so what's happening?
I don't work. You need to sit and watch the whole thing.
Yes, what? Yes, absolutely. But she was always like, she was never, not until later where she was very much into it. But yeah, before it was very much like that. So I remember those nights quite well. But the real kind of moment was me and my father, we were watching for the first time in entirety, a movie called Sholay, which is a very classic Indian, but like film, which on its own is genius for so many different reasons when it comes to Bollywood history. But for me, it was very important because, so my father was a big fan of Amitabh Bachchan, who is, again, a legend, legendary actor, excuse me, in India.
These are all Bollywood movies.
Yes.
Just in case our viewers
are right, exactly, yeah.
They are,
that's what I grew up on. I grew up on Bollywood because I grew up most, like, started in India. So that's the industry, that's the kind of film that I grew up watching. So we were watching Sholay, and he was a big fan of Amitabh Bachchan, and he would spout the dialogues, like, word by word, verbatim, and he would know exactly what's going to happen, where the music cues would come in. And I remember when I saw that, it was eye-opening because it was the first time I realized that my father can emote. Like, he actually has the ability to smile and laugh and, you know, get really enthusiastic about something. And I realized that there's something about this thing that we're experiencing, this film, this thing that's on the screen that's connected with him. Right. Maybe it was the memory of the first time watching it, because Sholay is a classic. He watched it like when it came out, and I was watching it with him on TV. So maybe that's that. Maybe there's something about celluloids, like just the fantasy of an adventure. So I was like, there's some magic here that's happening that I need to investigate, because I don't know what it is.
Well, it sounds like it was like bridging the gap between the generations of your, you know, the generation between your father and yourself, and you found this common ground, which is like, well, I like this and he likes it too, and it opens all these doors, you know what I mean? Just in communication, just because you can share in something that's not academic, not like, you know, family related, in the sense that you're like hanging out with a bunch of relatives outside of family, where it like feels like work sometimes, but you're just enjoying the presence of the film and your father, you know what I mean? It's bonding. So that must have been a pretty magical moment, you know, just to discover that.
Yeah, it was amazing. And it was something, again, that made me realize that film has a power that, I mean, visual medium in general, art, I would go even just broader, art has a power to penetrate through the conscious of anybody. And it has a power to unite.
Film is like the most powerful medium, I think, of all.
Yeah.
It incorporates music, it incorporates art, it incorporates dance or movement or rhythm on that level. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of like, you know, it is the cinematic moment, because it's all done, you know, bringing it to your screen, whatever screen that is. And these days that screen can be a cell phone, it can be a screen, it can be a TV screen, but it's still a way that you capture the medium and present it, and that it has something that, you know, takes a very involved amount of methods to create it in its entirety. Mm-hmm. Between the filming, the editing, sound, actors, all of it. I think it is the ultimate medium for sure.
Yeah, no, I would say like art in general is very powerful, but you're right. Film is one of those things that brings all elements of art, visual, auditory, writing, literary, like everything put together. You know, that they call it, I guess, moving picture. So, right. Like, so it's everything, you know, it's every element put together to give you hopefully a very enjoyable, entertaining experience. And it's the only place that, you know, a lot of the times nowadays we're seeing a lot of films like via social media or some way that are kind of being used as tools to divide, you know, like, hey, like, you know, being very political or something. But I think film as a medium is probably one of the bigger unifiers.
Yep.
Because you'll have, again, I'll go into my comfort zone of Bollywood, because that's where I live mostly.
Right.
But you have, like, let's take a big, big star like Shah Rukh Khan, who is global, global star. He's got fans from Japan to Hawaii. Like, he's got fans everywhere.
Right.
You've got somebody from Europe and Germany that likes the same movies as a middle class person in Mumbai.
Yep.
You know, like, it's
that love Bollywood films.
Huge, exactly.
It's huge in Iran. It's like crazy.
Yeah.
And I'm like, when I learned how big, like, the market is for Bollywood films, it kind of astounded me, because it's like, you don't think when you're from there, like, the funny thing about me is, like, I grew up being fascinated with Western culture. So, mm-hmm. like, Western music, Western films, and I know very little about Bollywood films, and it's a part of my culture, but I know very little about it. So it's so interesting that that was your first experience into loving film, and how your father loved it too. And so there must have been, like, a lot of musical elements that your father loved as far as music in film as well, because that's what Bollywood, when I think of Bollywood films, I always think of, like, they're like Indian musicals, you know? So there's,
yeah,
music and theater in so much of in the way that it's presented, you know?
Yeah, no, for sure. Again, it's things that I learned over the years, and that was the first step into it, where, you know, he resonates with classic Bollywood and classic music a bit more than nowadays. So, like, you know, and if you think of, like, a classic Bollywood, there's a lot of elements of old school, you know, rock and old school coming in. You know, you look at R.D. Burman, or even as like, you know, those, they kind of took the Western elements of, like, jazz and rock, and brought them into rock and roll, and brought them into Indian kind of musical subconscious. So, yeah, he's a big fan of those kind of, that kind of music. And there's one thing, as I think he mentioned, or someone I know mentioned, where there's a differentiation of, like, back in the day, Bollywood music used to be melodious and thoughtful, where now it's just solely focused on beat. Wow. And that rings true. Like, you listen to songs nowadays, maybe even outside of Bollywood, I would say a lot of songs nowadays focus on beat versus melody.
Yep.
So, yeah, he's more of the melodious generation.
What's really interesting about what you said earlier, I wanted to talk about that. You said, you know, film and art in general are unifiers. My mom, I had this really cool conversation with my mom once, and she said she really believes the artists will be the people that actually unite the world. And I'm like, you're absolutely correct. And I kind of feel like sometimes sports can do that too, but really it can also divide us, because you're so, you know, into a certain sports team or a sport. But like, when it comes to art, it really does bring a lot of people together from so many diverse backgrounds. And it's not something that is, you know, geographically destined. You know, it's like, you can be into music you've never heard of from another country, and it just draws you in because of the elements that make up that song or that film or the way it looks, or, you know, a certain dance or a certain writing. And that's what makes it so beautiful. It's like, it can respond within all of us, because it documents the human condition. And it also, you know, kind of like helps us to congregate and kind of like acknowledge our differences, but in a united way, which does not happen anymore. You know what I mean? You don't see that. There's so much, you know, that's going on. Now, did you fall in love with Western film as well? Or did that take a lot longer because you were just more into Bollywood?
No, I did. Yeah, I did, definitely. So what happened was, when I kind of put my interest of film out there and to my family, saying, hey, I want to do this, I'm really interested in this. I remember this is kind of the very Indian nature of Indian parents, where it's like, my mom was like super supportive, but she's like, if you're going to do this properly. So she's like, here's a few courses, like summer courses, go take these, and then figure out what all this stuff is about. Because you look from the outside, hey, film, you know, glamour, glitz, awesomeness, but what does it take to make a movie, right? Yeah. What does it take? So learn it. So I remember going to my first summer course in Manhattan at the New York Film Academy. And it was a summer course. I was still in high school. And that was when I kind of really delved into Western cinema. Like, I knew about it, of course. I knew about Star Wars, and I knew about, like, I would watch shows. We would watch TV shows a lot, NCIS and Law and Order. And, like, again, all of this stuff is there. But the art of learning film and how it works, that was at that course where we delved into the classic, the legends, you know, Akira Kurosawa, and then you go into, like, later on, like, Scorsese, and that's when I really started delving into, like, legendary filmmakers and actually really watching their films as a way to understand how film is made.
Right.
And now I would just say, like, in general, like, I am just a film lover at this point. Like, I'll watch anything and everything.
Yes.
From anywhere, global.
Yeah, so. You know, I'm learning that some of the best stories are international stories.
Mm-hmm.
So I've gotten into, what I notice about myself is I get really into a certain genre of film. So, mm-hmm. like, I will get into documentaries, like, big time. Mm-hmm. And then I will totally abandon documentaries for the moment and get way into international film. And mm-hmm. I just fall in love with international stories and just great movies, like cinematic, accomplishments. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And then I come back and I go through a classics phase, mm-hmm. and I'm like way into old film to understand, like, this is why this is brilliant. So, like, you know, like, I hadn't seen the Godfather trilogy. So I watched that about 5 years ago, and I watched them all, and I was like, how have I never seen The Godfather? This is crazy. And so, like, now I try to dabble in each of them and just do, like, two movies and then move on to the next. But there was a time where I was just, like, so into the art form by genre that I would spend, like, a month or two and just watch as many films in that, you know, genre as possible. But, man, honestly, what I love about film is it encapsulates the human condition in such a beautiful way, mm-hmm. but it also challenges you to learn about another way of living, another kind of part of the world, another decade of living, another era, or, you know, generation right. of musicians or artists or whatever it is. And it kind of tells you this story in a way that is, you know, you're able to access something like this in 2 hours. Which is crazy. Like, if you think about it, a documentary or even a Bollywood movie, you're sitting there, and this is what I love about movies, you're getting these stories thrown to you in 2 hours, and by the end of it, you've seen something that challenges your beliefs, you've learned something about something you never knew, you laughed about something you never thought would be so funny, and these kind of, like, movies are the things that document your life. Like, when you remember when you saw E.T. or you brought up Star Wars, perfect example. Mm-hmm. I remember when, you know, like, when you were talking about how you fell in love with movies, for me it was Star Wars. When I first saw Star Wars as a kid, I was like, there's nothing greater than seeing, I still remember the feeling of seeing Return of the Jedi.
Oh, wow.
And, like, that was a monumental experience. That's what made me fall in love with movies. And I love that you still love movies like that. Do you still go out and see movies?
Oh, yeah. I'm a huge theater person. You know, I've got the, I don't know if we can do brand names, but I've got that specific, like, subscription, the, you know, monthly, like, I pay monthly fees and I go, like, watch 3-4 movies a month. Like, that's
awesome.
That's what I do.
I'm always looking to go see movies. I love movies, man.
Yeah, of course. Because that's, I feel like, of course, recent events kind of made us all little hermits, and we're watching stuff on smaller screens, and I know some people that watch whole movies on their phones, like 2-hour movies on their phones, and, you know, if that works for you, great, you're an audience member, I respect it, but movies, film is meant to be a collective experience. It's there's a reason somebody put in time, effort, bunch of money in order to create something, and then more money to put it out on a big screen theater. And still, you know, there are people that are like, oh, I'd rather watch it at home. And that's fine. Again, from an audience's perspective, I get it. It's comfortable. You're at home and you can go on your own pace. You can pause the film if you want to take a break. But I feel like films are a collective experience, and anybody who says otherwise, like theaters are going to go away, they aren't going away. I say we might move to a technological advancement where the collective experience of it might change, but right. The idea of the collective experience, I don't think that's going to go away.
There's nothing more exciting when you see a movie with a packed movie house and everybody's reacting to the same things at the same time, clapping, laughing.
Yeah.
Like, you know, or if something scares people, I mean, it's intense to have a group experience like that. And that's what makes, I think that's what makes movie houses so iconic for me. I always love going to see movies in a theater because of that experience. Even if it's like six people in the theater, it doesn't matter. It's like, okay, all of a sudden now you're watching something and experiencing something together. So tell me how this shaped you as a filmmaker, because now you've learned. You've gone through school. You've taken these classes. Did you go to film school after high school?
Not right away. I got my bachelor's in political science and sociology. And then I did a stint in law school. And then I realized that this was just pushing the inevitable and ended up coming out to LA for pursuing my master's. And then that was film school. Like, that was my true film school. I've been doing that since
then. Where did you do your master's?
Sorry?
Where did you do your master's for film?
New York Film Academy.
Oh, here. Amazing. Yeah. Awesome. So it put you in the environment. And what was the biggest thing that you learned when you were in school? Like, you're obviously in – this is what I learned going to music school. It's like – all of a sudden you're in the company of artists and people that love what you love. And it's like, man, some of my favorite times in music school weren't the classes. It was the hangs with people talking about movies or films or things that inspired them and learning about musicians or movies or poetry or paintings that you were just like, I've never heard of this. And they're like, oh my God, let me show you this stuff. Like, what was film school like for you coming into this culture and kind of like adapting to this new world?
Yeah, I would say it was a very similar experience. You know, you're around a group of artists, basically. And everybody comes from different backgrounds, but and they might have different perspectives on how to shoot something or what films are good and what films are bad. But at the end of the day, the pursuit is the same, and that is to tell stories. So you're among storytellers. So yeah, it was definitely a very, very, very nice to be around folks that understood that, that we're all here for the same purpose. You know, we're all here to pursue that same, to learn more about the art of storytelling. That's why we're here. So, and it was definitely, you know, we had a film history class, and that was one of my favorites. I love practical stuff and I love doing things on set, but I really, really enjoy delving into the history of stuff.
Right.
And cinema, you know, a lot of the things that we learned, I remember I had never seen, speaking of, like you said, you'd never seen Godfather. I had never seen Casablanca until film school.
I still haven't seen it.
And same with Citizen Kane, you know, like I'd never seen those until film school. And I remember watching Casablanca, the black and white version, and same with Citizen Kane, and just completely be engrossed, especially with Casablanca, just be engrossed with everything. And it was such a such a wonderful story. And if you haven't seen it, you should, you know, even the listeners, if you haven't seen it, you should definitely see it. It's a classic for a reason. You know, it's
It takes place in Morocco, doesn't it? Doesn't it take place?
Yeah, it takes place there. It takes place in a particular time period. It also, a little interesting tidbit of history. It was shot in a time where Hollywood was going through a very kind of sensory era called the haze. There was a haze code involved. So basically it was where you couldn't show certain things on film. And, you know, that was one of the last films to be part of that. So there's a very particular, it's a bit of a spoiler. I don't know if you care.
I've seen it. Go ahead.
But at kind of the base story is, you know, like basically they come to this character Rick's cafe, and there's a past love affair that this woman has with him. But she's married at this point. I believe it's married or engaged at this point. And the whole story takes like about their past love affair. Is she, will they, won't they? And then at the end of it, she sticks with the husband. And, you know, that's seen as one of the, again, finer storytelling things. But one thing that most people don't know is because it was part of the Hays Code, as a writer during that time, you couldn't show adultery. So, like, it wasn't really a choice for her character if she was already married for her to, you know, they talk about sacrifice of Casablanca and her character. Like, he sacrificed his love for the war effort, basically. And the thing is, he didn't have a choice as a character. Because, like, if Casablanca was made a few years later, who knows, it could have ended differently. And it wouldn't have maybe been the same film, and it probably maybe would not have been a classic. So... Right. It's like, I love when all of those things, when you look at all of that stuff and you say that this is why it is, it had to happen at that moment. And it's a classic because it was made like that. So
I love that. And you recently made an awesome short. I actually just watched it, called Butterscotch, and you've been winning some awards for it. And I got to tell you, I didn't know what it was going to be about, and it really hit home. Because it's about a kid living in a South Asian household and getting the pressure to do academics, and she wants to be an artist. And it really hit home for me because that's been my life. It's like, you know, I came from a very academic family, and I still come from a very academic family, and I wanted to be an artist. And I know what that pursuit is like, and it's not easy, especially for South East Asian families or artists, you know, on both sides, because it's like when you have a passion, you don't want it to be predestined. You don't want your life to be, that's not what life's about. It's about the unexpected. It's about the unknown. So I love that you make this film about that. Let's check out the trailer real quick, and then we'll talk about the movie. Here's the trailer for Butterscotch. Cool. How did you figure out how to make the trailer? Because I know that's such a specific thing, and also it's very hard because your film is 15 minutes long, and it's like you have a couple seconds to like tell the story. How did you figure out what scenes to use?
Putting a trailer together is difficult at the best of times, and the thing is, we only have about 15 minutes of footage, so doing like a 1 minute trailer for a 15 minute, like, it doesn't make sense because I was like, it has to be like 30 seconds. It can't really go more. And there was a choice to be made whether we put any dialogue in it or not. And I really, as a viewer, I love watching vague trailers, like trailers that maybe touch you emotionally, but they don't, like, they don't tell you much. Like, what the movie's about, or, you know, that way you're like, oh, I wonder what the film's about. Let me watch this. That's why we chose no dialogues, and we chose like not to, you know, focus too much on giving much of the story away. So what I think what you see in the trailer is these two characters, something happens. There's a paper. So you're like, something happens between them, and then they're put on two opposites. And it's also not the whole story, because as you've seen the film, that's not where we finish, you know? So it's kind of like, I'm giving you, you know, like, hey, this, I'm giving you a bit. So maybe you can watch it and see what happens.
Well, what's also interesting too, like, having seen the film, like, you took very dramatic parts. You're like, I'm going to give you some juicy, dramatic parts of the trailer.
Yeah.
And it's kind of cool that you did that, because it makes it like, oh my God, this is intense. But it's really like a really simple story, and something I know every Asian artist can relate to, because, you know, it's like, academics are very important in the Southeast Asian community. It's like, mm-hmm. people don't really understand how much that is an emphasis on how you should guide your life and career with mm-hmm. academics. You know, that's like a staple. And you're creating a story where I think a lot of artists can relate to this, where it's like, yo, I'm going to do all this, but when it comes time for me to choose my life, I'm going to choose what I want to do. And that alone is a very, like, revolutionary concept, especially because in Southeast Asian cultures, most of the time the parents kind of, they influence what the kid should do as a career.
Right.
So that they can tell their friends about what their kid's doing as a career,
yeah.
whether or not it makes them happy. So tell me, what was the inspiration behind this for you as an artist?
Well, that was a lot of it that you just said, like a lot of that, where, you know, I've seen, I will admit, I probably didn't face as much resistance as I kind of mentioned before, you know. Actually, my father and mother were both artists in their own rights. You know, my father is he's a poet. He loves to write, and my mother was a musician, an Indian classical musician. So she played the sitar. So wow. Yeah, and I would accompany her on tabla back in the day. So
that's awesome!
It's
we'll have to jam sometime, because
I haven't played in years, honestly. So I don't know how good I am anymore. But so like the art. Arts were always encouraged, and when I told my mom, hey, I want to be a filmmaker, like I'm interested in films, and you know, the next day she's like, here's like 10 programs, you should check this out. So they've always encouraged me. That was always there. But there's also that kind of thing in the back of the mind that you don't go into it blind. You know, you have a backup. You have, that's the more traditional elements of Indian parenting coming in, you know, like, you know, you should have a backup, you should have some solid contingencies if this doesn't work out, kind of deal. So I did face a version of that, not exactly what the daughter faces in Butterscotch, but kind of similar. So I wrote the story out of just wanting to talk about it and maybe providing a different perspective also from the parent side. Which I think there's a lot of stories about artist children that don't necessarily get their way. But I think we don't really see much stories where we find out why their parents behave the way they do,
right.
and why they want what they would consider a better path, better career path, better path in life. And of course, in a short, you don't have much time to delve too deep into many things. But, you know, I hope, you know, a little bit of like the reasoning behind the mother's choices on why she is a little bit controlling, it comes out. You know, I hope that comes out a little bit.
Yeah. And
another thing I wanted to encourage is... kind of this idea of communication, because parents and children, especially those on two different sides of an issue, don't always communicate.
Right.
And they put up a wall, and that's happened many times. And I think that this story, I wanted to show that one side has to be like, hey, we need to talk. We have to talk about this. So I just want to say, like, you know, you're talking about South Asian parents and South Asian story, but this particular story is a little more broad. You know, it's not just Asian culture, because we've been taking it through festivals, and we were in like Cincinnati, which is our first like world premiere, and there was an audience member who was from kind of rural Ohio who had come to see the festival, and she was a teacher. And she was a white American rural Ohio teacher, and she's like, this movie should be shown to parents, because it's you know, a lot of parents have trouble figuring out why their kids behave the way they do, and it's like, yeah, this is why I'm showing this to these people. This is why I created this, so that it can kind of, you know,
open the dialogue basically. Well, exactly. What's also really cool too, it's like you show the daughter has the ability. You can see it in the first moment. And what's really cool about your movie is how you link the butterscotch ice cream to the two characters. Because I'll tell you, when I first saw the butterscotch ice cream, I was like, how the hell, why, what? You know, I was like, how is this going to tie in? Like, this is crazy. And it's endearing how you kind of like bring it as, it's almost like an offering, you know, like how you bring
this
between these two characters that are, you know, not seeing eye to eye in a lot of ways. And the cool thing that you do too is you show these characters kind of like reflecting on their own things, their own demons in a negative way. And, you know, the uncertainty of the unknown is definitely presented, but it's also like you do it in a way where you show each character individually separate of the other character, kind of going into the depths of their own like path and figuring out how to come to the crossroads and walk through the fire. You know what I mean? So do you think there was a moment when you were writing this where you felt like you had that moment in your own life where it was like, okay, this is my crossroads. This is what I know, what I have to do. Because it's so poignant that you're an artist in a South Asian family, and then you wrote something that is what every South Asian family probably secretly deals with that nobody talks about within the South Asian community.
Yeah. Funnily enough, I think this film is that crossroads. It's when I showed it to my father, showed it to my grandparents, and, you know, immediately there was a sense of pride that they had, which, you know, and I'm sure, like, I don't want to diss my dad. I know he loves me, and I know he is proud of me, but you know how parents can be a bit, especially fathers can be a little conservative with their emotions. So, it wasn't until he saw the film where he was like, this is good. And that was the crossroads in my kind of journey, where I created something and I showed it to them, and they're like, this is actually pretty good. So it's like, it wasn't a complete waste in that sense.
Right. So, but it's also cool that they were supportive.
Yeah.
It could have gone the other way where they're like, what is this that you're doing? You know what I mean? And I spent all this money and time, and now you guys are saying this, you know what I mean? So, and I like that you use the short medium. Like, I love short films. It's like, it's a very underrated medium, and it tells very effective stories in a concise amount of time for a reason. And that's the beauty of the art form. I love when shorts give you a beginning, middle, and end, and you're like, oh yeah, this is a fantastic story, and this could have been a feature. You know what I mean? So do you have like a hope for this to be a feature, or is this just like one part, one facet of a bigger story?
I mean, I didn't make it in the hopes of expanding it. I think it's kind of a glimpse into the life of these characters.
Right.
And we have seen that. And of course, all characters, as a writer as well, like all characters, I'd love to explore and expand. But I think this lives in that time frame. Like, that's the story. That's not to say that other aspects of similar life cannot be explored, you know, other aspects of like parent child dynamics or old generation, new generation dynamics, or, you know, like NRIs versus people in India dynamics, like those are all there, you know, there's things worth exploring. For sure. But for me, Butterscotch lives in those 15 minutes. Like that's where it stays. But yeah, and I do hope that, you know, the more people watch it and, you know, I hope they are able to realize that, you know, wherever you come from, whatever path you choose, as long as there's honest and open and sincere communication, that you can always get beyond the hurt and you can always get beyond the differences.
Well, there has to be heart and whatever.
Yeah.
Whatever you have, that has to be the reason for taking the path. You know what I mean? It's like, yeah. If you don't have heart, then there's no sense of communication. I've got a technical question, a couple of technical mm-hmm. questions.
Sure.
So, like, I'm going through a video series right now that I'm kind of directing and producing. Now, what did you shoot it on, and how many cameras did you shoot it on? And the second question is an editing question. Mm-hmm. Like, how did you – you really edited this very beautifully. Like, I really acknowledge really great editing when I see it, and it's something I'm learning is kind of a, its own art form, you know,
because yeah.
like, editing really tells a story in a lot of ways and in all the right ways. So first, what did you shoot it on? How many cameras did you shoot it on? And then when it came to the editing process, what was your philosophy and kind of like, you know, form of editing the project?
Yeah, so we shot it on a Red Dragon. And so our director of photography, Ritik Reddy, he's a genius guy. And he was able to let us have this amazing piece of tech. You know, the Red Dragon is a beautiful, beautiful camera. Yeah. And what we ended up doing, it's a single camera setup. It was one camera. And what we ended up doing was he's somebody like me who kind of loves to fuse new tech with old. So we used the Red, and then we added old, I believe they're called Leica lenses, like vintage lenses on there. So basically like, I don't know if you noticed that there's a bit of a filmy grain to it, like it felt cinematic, and that's the lenses. That's what the lenses are bringing. And that was his idea. He's like, I'd love to shoot this with vintage lenses. So that's what we did. We kind of fused new tech with old tech, and really we had the breadth of, for as an editor, I had all this a big canvas to edit with, like big. We shot in 6K, I want to say, so like big canvas to edit with. But then we also had the texture of film, right, which I thought was very, very cool. And as from the editing perspective, it was funny because the script itself is a 9-page script. So, I mean, if you know the 1 minute, 1 page yep. rule, it's like, it should be a 9-minute film.
Yeah.
But when we shot it, it just ended up being much longer. So
was that because the character asides or
yeah,
moments yeah. Of quiet, like within their minds?
Exactly.
That took a little bit longer?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, on script, it was like, you know, Maya, who's the mother, like Maya contemplates her daughter's words. And that's the shot in front of the mirror. And also when she's looking through her old things, like, that whole thing is like two sentences in the script. So of course on screen it's much longer. So but because of that, the whole sequence where the daughter gets angry and tears everything up, that sequence was originally shot as a one shot. So we shot everything together, but this is something that you're asking about the editing, where yeah. when I was looking at it as a one shot, it felt almost disconnected with the emotions she was feeling to me as an editor. because yeah, the performance was great. You know, Mehak and Srisora, who was Srisora's the mother, Mehak was the daughter. They gave amazing performances. But as I was editing it, and there's a cut where the whole one shot of that we're tearing the whole thing down is there. But I just felt like if I'm that character, I'm disjointed. You know, right. I'm not thinking straight. The rage, the upset, the sadness has taken over. So I was like, it has to be jarring. It can't be a, like one take shaky. Like it has to be like, oh, she comes in, cut. She goes paces, cut. She, you know, sits, thinks, gets that. Like all that has to be a bit jarring because that's how she's feeling at the moment.
Right.
So yeah, those choices had to be made. And speaking of music, there was a big decision of whether we put music in that particular sequence or not. And there's a cut where there's music in that sequence, but I decided not to go with it.
Because the emotion was in the image?
The emotion was in the image, and whatever score we were putting felt way too much musically to me. And I didn't feel like we could do justice to the performance if we overshadowed it with the music. Right. So like, and the music again with another, like a lot of South Asian crew behind this project as well. So Mayuresh Madgaonkar, who's a Mumbai based musician, amazing musician, composer, he did the score. So all of that was original soundtrack, original score for the movie. And that was a discussion me and him had where it's like he thought that we needed the music, but then once he saw it necessarily without it, then, you know, it's like as a musician, I'm sure you understand too, like, oh, we need music and it can heighten. It definitely can heighten. But sometimes I feel like I'll watch a movie and it'll be like, man, I don't know if we needed that much music for this also, particular scene.
Also need space. Like,
yeah.
Space is what creates some of the emotion too, because
yeah,
you have an inhale and then you have the music can kind of be the climax or the kind of like solution, the resolution to
yeah,
whatever the dilemma is. You know what I mean? So sometimes yeah, the space when you're kind of like showing the conflict is enough. So I actually like that it was abstract in that, you know?
Also, I felt like there, the kind of jolt that she receives, you know, that the daughter and the mother, both of them receive, they both handle it differently, right? So the daughter gets enraged, but it's one of those where I felt that, again, adding music would just make it worse. And I'm thinking, if I get enraged like that, I'm having like almost a silent rage within me. So that's what I felt her character needed. And then while the mother does have a silent kind of upset, she ends up going down late, like, you know, she ends up going down memory lane later too. So that was like, you're right, we needed a breath like in the tenseness. And I wanted people to sit with the emotion. I think sometimes music keeps us from sitting with that emotion because right, music cues us. Music says you have to feel this way because I'm cueing you to feel this way, but it doesn't let you feel if you want, like not always, however you want to feel. So,
well, you know, it's like you allowed us to stew. You
know? Yeah,
like,
exactly.
Like you allowed us to like, it adds the brooding element to it. Mm-hmm. You know? By just like allowing the visual to stand alone, which is cool.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And you show the conflict, you know. And I also, you said a silent rage. I'm like, Mayank, I've never seen you angry in the short time I've known you. I can't imagine you ever having silent rage, but apparently you know enough of it that it's in you to write about it because you.
Well, yeah. The thing is, I have a very, very long fuse. But the thing is, some people forget that I do have a fuse. So it's like, yeah. But yeah, I mean, yeah, you got that.
Yeah. So let me ask you this. What is next and where can people find this movie?
So right now, Butterscotch is doing its film festival circuit run. It's currently actually recently just got selected for the Poppy Jasper International Film Fest, which takes place up in Morgan Hill in California, which I will be there if anybody's listening and is in that part of the state. So it's making its rounds. It's still, you know, there's still a lot of festivals it needs to go to. So hopefully by like mid to later this year, we'll have it at a distributor or somewhere on a streaming platform or online somewhere, fingers crossed. But yeah, hopefully you guys can, you know, see it somewhere at a fest, hopefully in LA as well. There's a lot of fests that are still have yet to, you know, give us our decisions. But that's
part of the process. It's like,
yeah,
something really beautiful, and then you wait for someone else to interpret it for whatever reasons, whether it gets into a major festival or a smaller festival. It's like, man, it's so, this is what I don't like about art. And, you know, I had a meeting with a very well-known executive producer for documentaries, and he said, you know, the art, there's no suffering in the art. The suffering comes when after the art is finished. And we figure out where people can find it and where, you know, like that's where it starts. And I was like, that is so true. It's like finishing the craft is one thing, or finishing the art is one thing. And then the other part of it is finding the audience, finding the market, finding a way to get it so people can see it. So, but you're doing a great job. You're winning some awards. You're getting some awesome film festivals, and it's got to be super exciting. And we look forward to seeing many more films from you, Mayank. I think you're a very talented film director and writer, and I hope you never stop making movies. And where can people find you if they want to find more about Butterscotch?
So we're on Instagram. We are at Butterscotch_the film, I believe. And you can find me on Instagram as well. It's at MayankMD.official.
Spell it out.
It's at MayankMD.official. And we're on socials. I'm sure if you search my name, you'll find it. You're asking about what's next. I am actually planning on going to India in like a month, and I'm planning on shooting another short there. So that's my next thing.
Very, very, very cool. Well, Mayank, when that's finished, you have an open invitation to come on board and we'll do another interview with you, because you're a great cat and you're a very talented dude. And we look forward to many more films from you, man. And keep making these
movies,
because Butterscotch was amazing. And I can't wait to see what's next for you. So thank you for being a guest on Wake Up Hollywood. And you'll have to keep coming back. Every movie, you got an open invitation to keep coming back, man. That's
what absolutely. Thank you for having me. Thank you for having me on the show. I'm a big fan of yours, and I respect your work. So it's really great to have this experience. Likewise. this just talk, you know, and conversation.
I watched your film and I was like, man, this guy knows how to shoot up movies. We'll have to collaborate on something, man.
For sure. I look forward to it.
Movie, and we have to hang soon too, man.
Absolutely.
On behalf of Mayank, myself, and Sam, happy new year, everybody. Check out Butterscotch at a film festival near you and soon to be released. Cross your fingers, right?
Cross all the fingers.
Fingers and toes. All right. We'll see you guys here next week. Peace, love. Take care of yourselves. Take care of each other. Good luck in life, because it's a new year. Let's make shit happen. All right. We'll see you guys next week. Peace.
You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Corulla and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.